Welcome to Civilly Speaking with host Sean Harris. Each month, Civilly Speaking brings you interviews on practical and timely legal issues on the local and national level. We hope you enjoy today's show.
Hello, I'm your host Sean Harris, and this is episode 63 of Civilly Speaking, the podcast for members of the Ohio Association for Justice. I'm here with our guest today, Judge John O'Donnell, from the Cuyahoga County Court of Common Pleas. Judge O'Donnell is currently running for election to the Ohio Supreme Court. Judge O'Donnell, thanks very much for joining us here on Civilly Speaking.
I appreciate you having me. I look forward to a scintillating conversation.
Our topic today is the new civil rules that went into effect this summer, specifically Civil Rule 26, incorporating the concept of proportionality. Before we get started, I'd like to take a quick moment to thank our sponsor. Today's episode is brought to you by FindLaw. FindLaw wants to be a resource for all attorneys to improve their online presence and get hired by more clients. It's vital that attorneys understand the importance of their online brand matching their offline brand. In a post-pandemic setting, a firm's online presence will likely be their only presence. Potential clients should be able to find everything they need to know about you when they're searching for an online attorney. This includes a consistent logo and website, reviews, LinkedIn connections, videos, blogs, and legal directories. As a diamond sponsor and friend of the Ohio Association for Justice, FindLaw is here to help make sure you have everything you need to win online. Talk to your FindLaw rep for a free digital audit to make sure you're ready for business in 2021. FindLaw, the world's leading provider of online legal information for individuals and small businesses. All righty, Judge. We have a new set of civil rules that went into effect in July, and there's some significant changes specifically to Rule 26 dealing with discovery that most of our members deal with on a particular basis. What's your kind of 10,000-foot overview of the changes and the updates to Civil Rule 26?
They essentially conform to federal court. So if you have practiced some fair amount in federal court, you're not going to see much that is all that new here, and you're going to be ready to roll. If, however, you are strictly or primarily in state court, you need to acquaint yourself with Rule 26 because it has a couple things you absolutely have to do, and it has some other areas where controversies are going to arise, there's no question. So that's the 10,000-foot view.
And when we talk about controversies arising in the discovery process, the new rules specifically contemplate increased judicial involvement. We were kind of talking before earlier. Most trial court judges that I know are very busy, have a full criminal docket, don't have a lot of time to deal with civil discovery, don't like dealing with civil discovery, and yet these rules are mandating that the court involve itself more in civil discovery disputes.
Unquestionably, and the staff notes make that explicitly clear. I think the practical effect that's going to have on the progress of discovery is it's likely to slow it down. It has been my experience that me and my colleagues are busy with many things, including, of course, civil litigation. And if you give us one more thing to be busy with, hopefully we'll get to it timely and reasonably. But we're all human. And if we can put it off another day because something else is more urgent, maybe we will. And the next thing you know, discovery has ground to a halt.
So for our members who are dealing with the new rules, from your perspective, sitting on the bench, what tips could you share with us as far as if we're going to come to a court to make your job easier in deciding a discovery issue under the new rules?
If you have a discovery issue with your opponent, either they are not providing you something you think you're entitled to, or they're asking you for something you think you don't have to provide either then or at all, because a lot of disputes are about the question of timing. Do I have to provide this now before I've done A, B, and C? Am I going out of order? If, in other words, if you have a dispute that somehow centers around something you have done or declined to do, make sure you come to the court, and I'll borrow a concept from equity here, with clean hands. In other words, make sure that you have done that which you're required to do under the rule, made the initial disclosure, which we might talk about for a minute or two here, which I think is a huge change, that you've met and conferred. By the way, on the meet and confer, I think emails back and forth, to me at least, being one of however many common pleas judges in the state, that suffices for the meet and confer. But some of my colleagues may want an actual at least phone conference or an even in-person conference. Hard to say, so that kind of thing you learn as you go judge by judge. But make sure you've at least done something that can qualify to meet the obligation of a meet and confer, and do whatever else is necessary to show that you are trying to avoid a dispute and it's your opponent who is perpetuating it.
You mentioned the initial disclosure, something that's been common in federal court for quite a while, but is new to Ohio now.
Exactly. So anyone listening can read the rule for him or herself, but it's worth noting that that I'm talking about Rule 26B3, and this requires that without awaiting a discovery request, you must provide to the other parties certain information. And essentially, it's in the rule, so I'm not going to read the rule here. But these disclosures must be made. So these are things that typically are going to be discovered anyway. Often they would be addressed in the first set of interrogatories, you would imagine. But you got to be ready to do it. So for your members who are ordinarily, not always, but ordinarily the party filing the lawsuit, be ready to get this info out. And I will say this from a court's perspective, and I've spoken with colleagues who are with me on this. It's a non-answer to say when you as a plaintiff get initial discovery, not determined as of yet, will supplement. First of all, will supplement is redundant. You're supposed to supplement.
You have an obligation to do that anyway.
Right. So you need to say, you need to give some information if the information exists. Now, if it doesn't exist because you were running up against a statute and your client only came to you a couple weeks ago, I would lay that out. I would give a reason why the information doesn't exist. But so often I see initial discovery requests which basically say, I haven't decided this yet, I'll let you know when I do. Not always in those words, but sometimes in words like that. It's hard to come to the court looking for relief from oppression by your opponent when you've given answers like that, which are really non-answers. So I would caution people, when you're making these initial disclosures, if they're scant, give the reason why they're scant. And usually it's going to be, hey, I more or less just got the case. Most of the evidence, I believe, is in the hands of the defense, but I'll give you what I know so far. But I would say do not ignore the initial disclosure because your opponent will pounce on it saying, look, my esteemed colleague has filed a lawsuit. He's required to give us information. He hasn't given us a bit of information. This makes me think the lawsuit has no merit, and maybe the court should start thinking that way too.
You know, on the topic of discovery and interrogatory answers, I wanted to get your thoughts on something that I've noticed recently. I don't know if this has been brought to your attention, but I'm getting lots of responses, written discovery responses, and that before they've begun answering any of the questions, there's a list of 8 or 10, quote, general objections, which seems to be a new fad. And if, whether it's a deposition or interrogatories, my understanding is that it's sworn testimony as if it were in live and open court. You can't stand up before the witness starts testifying on the witness stand and say, before this witness says anything, I'd like to give these 10 objections. Have you seen that? What are your thoughts about that practice?
The difference you just mentioned is possibly why it is done. In other words, if you, in writing, can say, here's 10 objections, and then here's my answer subject to those objections, then I guess you do it because maybe you believe you're preserving some argument for later. As you mentioned, in the deposition or a trial, especially context, you can't stand up and say, my client or my witness is going to testify, but subject to all these objections, okay, go ahead. That, to me, is not as necessarily new phenomena. I think some of that is gamesmanship, because oftentimes I will see all those objections, but then reasonably substantive answers are given. So are they just trying to create some doubt in their opponent's mind about whether the things really are discoverable? Are they making plain to the opponent, hey, I'm not laying down for anything on this case? It's hard to say. Personally, I don't like to do things that are unnecessary. Maybe I'm lazy that way. But on the other hand, it's no effort. I'm sure there's a form listing all the objections, and it's a couple keystrokes and you get them in. I will say this. I haven't seen, and in speaking with my colleagues, they haven't mentioned it, disputes arising over that stuff, which I guess is good. So maybe they're just trying to get in your head a little bit.
Mission accomplished.
Yeah, right, right. And I think gamesmanship within the rules, that's part of litigation.
We're talking about the changes in the new Civil Rule 26 in Ohio under the civil rules. And nothing to me is larger or potentially more impactful than the concept of proportionality. Gone is the phrase reasonably calculated to lead to the discovery of admissible evidence. We now have incorporated this concept of proportionality. Of course, the fear on the plaintiff's side is that that is yet another objection, yet another roadblock to legitimate evidence production. And that even though the rule says you can't just boilerplate object, this is not proportional, with gamesmanship, that's going to happen. How do you approach the concept of proportionality and the factors that are laid out in the rule?
Well, I would say from a practice tip perspective, make sure that if you have discoverable information, you have given it over. And you've made clear to your opponent, essentially by giving over what you have, and it might be limited, that you believe the evidence that's most supportive of your cause of action is in your opponent's possession. I would make that clear so that the court knows, if and when it comes to the court, that it's the kind of case that the staff notes contemplate, which is to say where discovery is asymmetrical, or the amount of discoverable information in possession of each party is asymmetrical. Very often that is the case, I would expect, with the members of your organization. So make that clear. And then I would also be quoting to the court some of the language from the staff notes, which is pretty good, which makes it clear that just because one side is asking for a lot and the other side isn't asking for that much, that's not the end of a proportionality inquiry. It's not, hey, I've given 10 depositions, he's given one, he's offered one. Obviously, it's disproportionate. That is just not the case. Make sure you familiarize yourself. Again, there's no need for us to read the rule here. Everyone can read. But make sure you familiarize yourself with the proportionality analysis that it requires. And make sure, I would say, especially in the next months and year, make sure you familiarize the court, because some of us may not have read the rule. Obviously, it's easily available, but you may have trial judges across the state getting a proportionality objection, and they're thinking, what is this all about? And they just see the numbers. Oh, yeah, that the one side is given a ton of stuff, the other side not much. That's enough. Make sure the court knows the rule without insulting the court. So that can be a fine line to walk.
We were talking earlier how, as with most discovery matters, certainly these are as well, that the decision is up to the discretion of the trial court. Much discretion is placed in the trial court's decision, and so best to come prepared from the get-go.
No question about it. You need to be prepared, by the way, for both outcomes, one that favors you, one that doesn't, because you're pretty much stuck with the result, unless we're talking about privileged material, which is probably a small subset of the whole kinds of evidence you're trying to collect. Here's a question I want to ask you, Sean. Have you ever gotten a call from your opponent saying, you know what, I'd like to depose your client again. Either I forgot to cover this, that, or the other, or I need to ask him or her about such and such. Have you ever gotten that kind of call?
For sure. Usually it's in the context of hopefully new information, you know, records that they didn't have, and hopefully they have reserved or brought up, you know, during the initial deposition, hey, this might be something coming down the road. But gosh, out of the blue, I forgot to ask something. They can ask. I would not look too kindly on that request otherwise.
And I don't fault you for that, but people should know that there is, under Rule 26, there's no limit on the number of depositions that a particular person can be required to give. Now, certainly by tradition, it's once and you're done, unless the parties can agree that new substantive information has come to light, that fairness dictates the person gets to be redeposed. But if you're coming to the court with this kind of dispute and you just kind of rest on the proposition that, hey, they had their chance, or if your opponent does the same, that's really never been the rule. And I think it's now explicit that the number of depositions is not fixed by rule. So just be wary of that when that kind of thing comes up, either from the other side or when you yourself want to take a second or sometimes even third deposition. Again, not only might the court, particular court that you're in, not be familiar with this rule, it being so new, it's possible your opponent isn't either.
I would say more than possible. It's likely, right? That's at least a sea change in the way we think about taking depositions.
Right. And to me, from a plaintiff's perspective, and most of your members, as I understand, tend to represent plaintiffs, it may be advisable, now this would depend on the case, to take a relatively early deposition of an important defense representative so that you can map out where discoverable information might be, who might possess it, and that kind of thing. And then once you get that discovery, it may be that the person you deposed, in fairness, has to be deposed again because now you've learned something. So sometimes we rely on our opponents to say, hey, you know, the guy you want to talk to at my defendant is so-and-so, something like that. Or your opponent may say, hey, I talked to so-and-so at my client, and here's the lay of the land. And usually you should be able to trust that that is accurate. But depending on the case and its importance, you may consider taking a pretty early deposition, reserving your right to redepose the person so that that person with knowledge can give you a roadmap of your future discovery. Something to think about, again, depending on the case.
Well, Judge, we mentioned at the outset that you are in the midst of a campaign for the Supreme Court of Ohio. Obviously, this is an unusual climate to be campaigning in, given the pandemic situation. How goes the campaign?
So far, so good. And you know, since I'm campaigning for office, part of that is I'm contractually obligated anytime there is a microphone in front of my face to say a few words about it. So I'm glad you brought it up and not me. It makes me look a little bit less pushy. Your members may or may not know, and others listening to this, but I'm running against Justice Sharon Kennedy, who has been on the court for about 8 years. This is a chance, as far as I'm concerned, to change the tenor of the court. And things are looking good. I'm getting very good support from the legal community. And I want you to know, and I want your listeners to know, that the latest poll we conducted has me up 8 points against Kennedy. And that tells me one important thing. When I got into this race, there were people loath to challenge her because they thought the name Kennedy was so powerful and couldn't be overcome. I haven't overcome it yet. I'm confident I'm going to win, but obviously anything can happen in November. But what this poll shows me is voters' initial reactions, and let's face it, voters don't know a lot about O'Donnell or Kennedy. Their reaction is to the name, who they think they might know or have heard of. And if that poll is any good, that shows that my name is equally as strong, if not more than hers. And so for those voters who just pick by name, I should be okay. And I'm confident enough to say that for those voters who know a thing or two about the justices and the other candidate, namely me, they'll see that I'm going to be the better fit for Ohioans on the Ohio Supreme Court.
Well, Judge O'Donnell, thanks very much for being here on Civilly Speaking.
Sean, I appreciate you having me here, and I am glad that you lived up to the name and that this was a civil conversation.
Anytime. And thanks to our listeners out there. As an update, Civilly Speaking is on iTunes and now on Spotify, which is very impressive to my kids. If you like our show and want to learn more, check out civillyspeaking.com and leave us a review on iTunes. And we'll see you here on the next episode of Civilly Speaking.